and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, Sir Peter Westmacott. Westmacott is the British ambassador to the United States. His talk on UK-Alaska relations was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and the World Trade Center of Alaska. It was recorded May 28th at the Petroleum Club in Anchorage. British Honorary Consul in Alaska and UAA Professor Emeritus Diddy Hitchens introduces Peter Westmacott.
It's always a great pleasure to be here amongst friends and colleagues at the World Affairs Council and with the World Trade Center of Alaska, and I thank both of those organizations for hosting our speaker today. It is truly a privilege to be in the position to quite regularly bring distinguished speakers from Great Britain, from the United Kingdom, to come to speak to Alaskan audiences. Today, it is my privilege to introduce Britain's current ambassador to the United States. Sir Peter Westmacott was born in Edington, Somerset, and also grew up in Weston-super-Mare in Somerset in the southwest of England in 1950. He was educated at Taunton School and at New College, Oxford. He joined the British Foreign Office in 1972, initially joining the Middle East Department and taking Persian language training. In a distinguished 40-year career with the Foreign Office, he has had postings with the European Commission in Brussels, Belgium, in Paris, in Ankara, Turkey, and in the USA, where he has served twice. He has served as Chief of Staff to Ministers, as Director for the Americas, and on the Board of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Since 2000, he has been on the Board. Prior to becoming British Ambassador to the United States in 2012, he had served as British Ambassador to Turkey from 2002 and subsequently British Ambassador to France from 2007. For his services, he has been made a Knight Commander of St. Michael and St. George Order, and also a Lieutenant of the Royal Victorian Order and Commander of the Legion of Honor. Today, his talk is entitled UK-Alaska Relations and UK Foreign Policy Priorities. Would you please join me in a warm World Affairs Council welcome to Sir Peter Westmacott, British Ambassador.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Diddy, for those kind words of welcome. I didn't know I had a Legion of Honor, but I'm pleased to have one. thank you to the President of France, if he's given me one, without my knowing it. This is a great treat. Thank you all for coming here and for giving me the opportunity to talk a little bit about the United Kingdom, Alaska, a little bit about the UK's international priorities at the moment. I thought I would talk for a few minutes about those subjects and then do what I hope will be more interesting to people, which is to get engaged in a little bit of Q&A and discussion and to address some of the questions that might be on your mind. But let me talk a little bit anyway, by way of intro, about some of the things that are on mine. One of the things that I have discovered coming here to Alaska for the first time is that our links do go back quite a long way between the United Kingdom and this rather extraordinary part of the United States. Now, I'm not going to give you a long lecture, which you will know far more about than I do, about Captain Cook and coming back here in the 18th century. Not going to do any of that. Nor probably do I need to remind you that the real reason why the Russians agreed to sell Alaska to the United States was because they were scared they wouldn't be able to defend it against the Royal Navy in the 19th century. So it's thanks to us that you are who you are, and you're not speaking Russian, and voted for Mr. Putin in elections. But oddly enough, in just that year, 1867, when the sale took place, that was the same year when the young Mr. John Muir walked one of his first great adventures of 1,000 miles from Indiana down to Florida, and before he became what I think is known as the father of the national parks in this country, the man who finally explained, despite all the skeptics saying he was wrong, the origins of Yosemite, and came to Alaska and did some really very extraordinary things down in Glacier Park and the area southeast Alaska, where I had the privilege of spending much of the Memorial Day weekend with my wife. So I learned all about John Muir and the fun things that he did. And he and others, leaving behind a lot of names of distinguished Brits, called all sorts of things from Drake and Francis and Douglas and Admiralty Island and so on, which remind us of the fact that years ago there was an important British presence. There was even something called the Hudson Bay Company, but they got kicked out, unfortunately, immediately after the sale of Alaska. But they popped up again not very far down the coast, so they never really disappeared. But it's a rather wonderful reminder of that relationship and how far back it goes. But I'm also reminded that so much of that has remained intact. And if I look around at what really matters to the Alaskan economy today, the main sectors, whether it is tourism, whether it is fisheries, or whether it is the energy industries, in all those areas there is a very important UK content. BP have been here since the day when Alaska achieved statehood and has been the biggest single foreign investor and the biggest single employer in this state ever since, and we're very proud of that involvement. Shell, with whom I spent quite a lot of time with my colleagues this morning, have got a major presence here and are looking in a very cautious, responsible manner at the prospects for further exploration and production offshore, taking account, I think, in an extraordinary careful manner of the environmental sensitivities and so on. The United Kingdom is a very, very important market for the export of Alaskan seafood. I got a briefing about all that. And guess what? We are the world's principal container consumers of canned Alaskan pink salmon. Well, quite why that is, I cannot remember or know, but you pick up all sorts of exciting bits of information on a trip like this. We provide 1/3 of all the foreign tourists who come to Alaska. Brits are quite adventurous people, as they were back in Captain Cook's time, but they still like to make the trip and to explore the amazing scenery and come and see what's going on here. So that's an important part of the existing business relationship which we've got and of which we are very proud. And I will put that in a slightly broader context for a moment just by telling you that what we now exist for, those of us in the British Foreign Service, is to pursue a range of different activities which really fall under just 3 headings, one of which is prosperity, one of which is security, and one of which is consular protection for British subjects abroad who might get into difficulty and need our help. And under that heading of prosperity, that is everything to do with jobs and growth and economic development and foreign investment and exports and trade in both directions. It's always been something that we regard as a priority, but my present Foreign Secretary, present boss, William Hague, has reminded us that it is something which he thinks is the single most important thing for our Foreign Service, for ambassadors to do. And so in lots of different ways, both in economies where no business is conducted at all unless government-to-government negotiations take place and presidents or prime ministers sign off on the contracts, to wide-open economies like this one, where there is still an important role in ensuring that business leaders talk to each other and are aware of the different possibilities and are made aware of the reasons why, for example, the United Kingdom is, in our judgment, totally unbiased, the best place to make your foreign investments in the European Union single market if you are thinking of expanding into that part of the world. So that's an important part of what we do. And we, like everybody else, are trying to adjust the direction of the resources that we devote to looking after our interests. And we're looking at emerging economies, and we're looking at taking away some people from some of the bigger countries to some of the ones which are growing at much more rapid levels of growth. And that's all fine. We're moving resources south and east. But as I say to the people in charge of resource allocation back in London, that's fine. But do not forget that if we, with our network of trade and investment officers and consulates general across the United States of America, which there are 10, some of them with as many as 45 people, some of them just one person. If we can add 5% to the amount of trade that we do with the United States, that is like doubling what we do with Brazil, and it's like adding one third to what we do with China. In other words, where the existing patterns, where the existing relationships exist, let's not forget that a modest increase in what we do at the moment can make an enormous difference. We do between us, Britain, the United States of America, around £220 billion worth of business each year. And our next most important partner, which is Germany, we do 95 with. So, you know, more than twice as important as our immediate neighbor and second most important partner. It's just an indication of why this country is so important in business terms. And it goes both ways. We are the biggest foreign investors in the United States economy, but the United States of America are the biggest foreign investors in the UK. There are 1 million jobs in my country which depend on US investment. There are 1 million jobs in America which are created by UK companies investing in this economy. So we are really joined at the hip in terms of that business and prosperity relationship. And we are doing more and more in this direction to try to take that forward. One of the subjects that I should mention, I shall get my knuckles wrapped by my consul general if I do not, is the importance we attach to taking forward something called TTIP, which used to be called the European Union, United States Free Trade Negotiational Framework or something. Anyway, thank God the President of the United States shortened it to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, otherwise known as TTIP, which is something which the European Commission, on behalf of the 28 member states, is currently actively negotiating with the United States, with the United States Trade Representative, Mike Froman, and the rest of the US government. A very good thing to do, because if you are trying to emerge from a great recession, as we all are, and you're trying to create additional prosperity and jobs and stable business, what better way than to break down the unnecessary barriers to trade, get rid of the remaining tariffs, have the same set of rules and standards for your different technologies, get rid of some of the protectionist cozy practices which almost always represent a bad deal for consumers, open up your market, and allow free trade to reign. And since the European Union and the United States between us produce one half the world's GDP, it's not a bad thing to try to achieve that between us. We've just had the fifth round of negotiations. The difficult discussions are now getting going. But we remain optimistic, the United States government remains optimistic, that this will succeed. And we recently financed, my embassy, along with the Bertelsmann Foundation and the Atlantic Council, a little publication which gave an idea of just what the economic benefits would be. And on average, every state of the Union would see its exports to the European Union increase by 25% if we were able to secure agreement on a comprehensive free trade agreement. It'll be a little bit less for Alaska, partly because of the structure of the exports, but nevertheless, it is something which is well worth having and which we give a great deal of importance to. So that's a part of what we try to do under the overall heading of prosperity. I'll come back to security and foreign policy and some of the current issues in a moment, briefly. But let me say also something about our broader cultural relations and the general atmospherics, if you like, within which that business relationship and also the political links exist. It's now a couple of hundred years since we last find ourselves, Brits and Americans, on the wrong side of the battlefield. In fact, we're going to celebrate, I think, the final battle of the War of 1812, which mercifully few people can remember or know anything about, in January of next year. And I was rather touched when I was in New Orleans just the other day when the mayor, the governor, a lot of our friends down there, because we've got fantastic British community and big business interests there, and historic links down in New Orleans as well, were saying, we do not wish to celebrate, although we're quite pleased about it, that this was the first ever land battle won by the Independence Army of the United States, but we do wish to celebrate the beginning of 200 years of the most important military alliance that the world has ever known. And I thought that was rather a nice way of putting it, even if he was trying to make the British ambassador feel better about being on the side of an ignominious military defeat. But that's okay. But in fact, since then, it has been a remarkable relationship. And I think that what we have got now between the United States and the United Kingdom, which has been going all those years, and indeed started long before that, until you had this curious idea you didn't want to have the monarchy anymore. But otherwise, it's gone on extremely well over much longer than 200 years. But we have got an awful lot of common heritage. I was in Salt Lake City the other day where they told me that in the state of Utah, 80% of the population can trace their British ancestry, which I found really rather extraordinary. And something like 65% of all the state's exports went to the United Kingdom, something I had no idea about. It's part of the fun of this job, is traveling around different states and discovering these interesting bits of information about the historic links that exist. But today we've got, you know, so many things that link us together. There is, of course, that military defense relationship that I mentioned. But there's also a broader international relationship which brings us together every time there is some complex bit of geostrategic crisis anywhere in the world. We have the same values. We are members of the same club. We are members, permanent members of the Security Council of the United Nations. We are members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And we have a degree of interoperability and close integration between our armed services, the Brits and the Americans, which is actually unique in the world. British pilots fly F-35 American fighter aircraft. US aircraft will land on British aircraft carriers. We're busy building two new ones. And there is a degree of working side by side in Afghanistan, as there was in Iraq, as there is in Somalia, and anywhere where there is a need for countries, armed forces, which share values as we and the United States do, to be side by side. There you find the Brits and Americans doing these things together. And we've got a bunch of anniversaries which remind us of just how far we have come. Later this year, for example, in the Library of Congress in Washington, we will have a visit from the Magna Carta, which is one of the probably defining documents of all freedoms and of constitutional monarchy. Bill of Rights, if you like, is up there along with the Declaration of Independence as one of three great documents of human freedom, signed in 1215. Almost more important, it sometimes seems to me, to American politicians than it is to those of us back in the United Kingdom, where we sometimes forget what we've got. Anyway, Magna Carta is coming for a visit for 800th anniversary of the signature later this year. We've got the 450th anniversary this year of William Shakespeare's death. We've got the Globe Theatre going around the world with a production where they're going to take to every single sovereign country of the world to celebrate that 450th anniversary. In January of next year, unfortunately, just a few days apart from the 200th anniversary of the Battle of New Orleans, we also commemorate the 50th anniversary of Winston Churchill's death, which may be an occasion to remind ourselves of this rather extraordinary Anglo-American and how much he has done to secure our freedom during the Second World War. And so, lots of reminders, if you like, of how much we do together. In addition to the films we make together, the television programs of each other's country that we look at, the heroes, if you like, whether it is Churchill, or whether it is, for some people, Margaret Thatcher, whether it is going back to William Shakespeare, there are a number of things that we do to ensure that the next generation remains equally aware of how much we have got to do together. We have a series of scholarship schemes, for example, which ensure that we are lucky enough to welcome many of the best and the brightest of America's students to British universities, many of them on Rhodes or Marshall or Gates or Fulbright or other scholarships. 50,000 US students are at British universities every single year. 10,000 of ours come back here. I was just talking to friends from the University of Alaska a little earlier, and we were looking at ways in which we could take further forward the way in which our institutions of higher education could do more together. We do actually, between us, have the best in the world. You've got some of them here in Alaska. We have some of them in the United States. The international rankings of universities show that 18 of the top 20 universities in the world, whether it's the Shanghai list or the Times, the Higher Education Supplement, they are British and American ones. The top 10 in the world, they're all British and American. You know, nobody else actually comes close. This is an extraordinary treasure, and it gives us the chance to ensure that we continue to train our young people at the highest possible levels, and also to have an interchange between our institutions of higher education, which means that we remain aware of each other and learn from each other. And I'm a great believer in the idea that if you spend a couple of years in your early 20s, in those formative years as a young adult, in another country, studying abroad, that you retain an interest in and preferably an affection for the people you meet and the country you've been in and the culture which you have learnt about, which lasts with you for the rest of your life. I'm delighted, for example, that Ahmed Nasir, who is actually an Alaskan currently serving at West Point, has been awarded a Marshall Scholarship this year as one of the 30-odd Marshall Scholars whom we honour each year with a scholarship to go and study in the United Kingdom. I talked a little bit about anniversaries. Allow me to say a little bit about some other major events coming up in the next few months, which are big summit meetings, which remind us of, again, the values that we share and the importance of working together. The United Kingdom is going to be hosting the NATO summit in September. At the time when we agreed to do this, only about 9 months ago, there weren't very many takers, not least because you end up with a bill of 150 million for the policing. And not every government thinks that is a very good use of taxpayers' money, but we decided that we would do that. We're quite proud of the way that we can organize summits, G7s and G8s and Olympic Games and stuff like that. So we decided that we would volunteer for the NATO summit. At the time, I have to say, there were a lot of people around the world who said, well, okay, that's fine. But you know, the Cold War's gone, NATO is a creation of 1940s, what's it there for now? You know, you're scratching around looking for a role, it's got a bloated infrastructure, people don't even fill the jobs they're supposed to do in Brussels, and shouldn't we be thinking it? Guess what? You know, thanks to Mr. Putin and thanks to what's been on in Ukraine and Russia, not very many people are saying to us, we don't know why you're bothering to hold a NATO summit this year. It is clear that we still do need a North Atlantic Treaty Organization to defend our values and to stick up for the rule of law and to make very clear to other people around the world that the days of 19th century land grabs by autocrats, if not dictators, is not something which we are prepared to tolerate in the 21st century. So we will be doing that, but shortly before it, one of the initiatives of my own Foreign Secretary, which I know he's very proud, and actually so am I, because I've been quite involved in this work, is that 2 years ago he launched something called the Prevention of Sexual Violence in Conflict Initiative, which was something which Angelina Jolie really alerted him to through that extraordinary and harrowing film she made called In the Land of Blood and Honey about what happened during the Balkan Wars. And since then, 150 different governments have signed on to the declaration which we launched at the United Nations to try to eliminate the culture of impunity and the idea of rape as a weapon of war in so many of the conflicts which disfigure our planet and cause so much human suffering. But it is a message which seems to have begun to resonate, and we're going to do a 4-day long international summit next month in London, a summit like no other, William Hague, my boss, likes to call it, where we're going to engage civil society, we're going to engage governments, we're going to engage the armed forces, we're going to engage the young, and we are going to try to ensure that there is a new international culture whereby there will no longer be this, not just a culture of impunity, but a readiness on the part of certain governments, unfortunately, and certain militias and certain armies to prosecute their military objectives at the expense of women and sometimes now men as well, by using rape and other brutality as a weapon of war. That's something that we attach a lot of importance to. Secretary John Kerry, highly supportive. Hillary Clinton been with us since the beginning of this initiative. And just a month after that, not even a month, a week after that, there is going to be something called the Ocean Summit, chaired by your own Secretary of State, John Kerry, to look at three principal challenges of oceans. One is acidification, one is pollution, and the third is, I'll come back to it in a moment, but it's really, what is the global community going to do about dealing with what's happening to our oceans? It's partly about global warming, but it's also about overfishing, acidification, pollution. Those are the three topics. And we will be a part of that as well, and I think it's another indication of how coming together in pursuit of really important global objectives is something which the Brits and the Americans do well together. I mention the Ocean Summit because I think here in Alaska, where you have got such an extraordinary depth of Arctic knowledge and experience of what to do about melting glaciers, or what are we going to do about the whole question of the future of the polar regions, this is an area where I hope there will be a lot of interest in what John Kerry is doing, but where I think there should also be a substantial contribution from so much of the expertise here. Much of it, I would add, shared with centres of research and Arctic expertise in the United Kingdom. We have something called the British Antarctic Survey, of which we are enormously proud, but it's on the back of that climate science, polar science, that we have developed a series of areas of expertise in British universities. And it's for that reason that just last month, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, our finance minister, committed $200 million to build a new ice-breaking polar research vessel to take forward our contribution to global science and understanding of what's going on in the polar regions at a time when the ice is melting very, very fast and a whole range of different issues, whether it is navigation, whether it is global warming, whether it is what's happening to the oceans, are very much at the top of our international agenda. That against a background of a country, my own country, which has been the first of the modern industrialized nations to set legally binding limits to reduce CO2 emissions. We will be reducing our emissions by 20% by 2020 compared to the base of 1990, and we're going to go further than that in the future. Many others have got comparable objectives. None of them, no other countries have got something that is legally binding in the sense that ours is. So there's just a little sketch around some of the big international issues where I think we have shared interests and shared values, and where on the basis of a remarkable relationship that goes back a very long way to Captain Cook and beyond, Brits and Americans and Alaskans are able to do remarkable things together. Now, I haven't talked about some of the current global issues, what's going on in Syria, what's going on in Iraq, what's happening in Afghanistan, or indeed, where have we got to with President Putin in Ukraine, and the whole question of geostrategic stability in the Middle East or East Europe. Very happy to do that. I think perhaps all I would say is that at this time, when there are so many tricky issues simultaneously going on at the moment, it has never been more important for us to have the very close political relationship that does exist between our two governments. The White House tell me that when the President is looking at whatever international issue it happens to be, whether it's the announcements he'll be making today, perhaps he's already made at West Point about Jordan and Afghanistan, or what to be doing in Syria in the future, the first head of government that he turns to, the first person he calls, is actually the British Prime Minister. It has long been like that. It is not a surprise. It's just the way things work. The same applies with John Kerry, who was in London 2 weeks ago when I was there for a conference of ambassadors, along with most of our consuls general, including Priya, who is here today. There was John Kerry, the Secretary of State. First time ever he'd spoken to our annual conference of ambassadors, saying exactly the same thing, that the identity of views and values and the pattern of almost automatic cooperation that exists between us is one of the things that makes his life that much more worthwhile and that much more rewarding in terms of trying to get the international community to pull in the same direction. And I might add, if I may, that I think the Secretary Kerry's energy and determination in trying to deal with such intractable issues in and around the Middle East and further afield in the 15, 18 months that he has been is something which attracts all of our admiration. We wish he had been able to succeed more than he has so far in terms of the result, but we admire him enormously for the efforts that he has made to try to make a difference in those areas. So in any one of those different problematic bits of foreign policy, and there's plenty more that could be said about what we do together and about the different policy responses that we need to be taking forward. But I think I will stop there, having given you just that kind of thumbnail sketch of the overall shape of the relationship, and invite you to put any questions to me that you'd like to, either on things that I have said or on the things that, to some extent deliberately, I have not, in the hope that perhaps you'll raise them with me now that we've got a few moments to talk about things together. But thank you for being here, and thanks for your attention.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Sir Peter Westmacott, British Ambassador to the United States. This talk was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and World Trade Center Alaska. It was recorded May 28th at the Petroleum Club in Anchorage. From here, the talk moves on to a question and answer period.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador, for your discussion. So among the things that you haven't mentioned yet, the most recent round of elections for the European Union, and the people seem to be having a difficult time digesting the results. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on what this presages for the future of the EU and the UK's relationship to it.
Thank you. Nice, easy question to start with. It's a really good question. What does it all mean? I think that the results of the European Parliament elections, which did not produce a very high level of turnout, I think it was something in the low 30s in most parts of the European Union, are an indication that all is not well in the state of Europe. I think I would put it like that. What happened was, for those of you who haven't followed these things closely, in all the 28 member states of the European Union, there were elections to the European Parliament, and on the same day in most of us countries, there were local elections to local councils as well. And the principal result, which was not unique to any one country, was a very strong upsurge in support for what one might call fringe parties. Some of them anti-European, almost all of them anti-incumbent governments. In the United Kingdom, the top party was something called UKIP, UK Independence Party, which profoundly believes that it's time for the UK to leave the European Union. In France, the rather racist and xenophobic National Front came top. In Germany, there was a strong upsurge in support for Alternativ für Deutschland, which is a sort of German alternatives political party. And so this pattern was repeated through a lot of the European Union. Now, to some extent, this is just what you have here at midterm elections. You're fed up with life, you're fed up with the government, give them a good kicking. And when the real election comes around in a couple of years later, then we'll go back to our common sense and we'll vote for the political parties that we actually want to run our own national governments. Because part of this is about feeling that this is the European Parliament, it's a European Union institution, it's not our own country, it's a free vote, it's an opportunity to say what the hell we like, and to transmit a certain message of dissatisfaction to our national governments, but not really to do it in a way that is seriously going to directly affect our pocketbooks. That's the thought. The problem is that it's actually more serious than that, because over the years, what has happened is that the European Union's institutions, including the role of the European Parliament, to which these elections were taking place, has grown. And one of the immediate consequences of this good kicking, if you like, that national governments have received, is that the groupings of different political persuasions in the European Parliament are now saying, okay, you've seen the results, it's up to us now to determine who are going to be the principal officials, the President of the European Commission, and other senior members of the European Union's institutions. This hasn't happened in the same way before. So there's a bit of a challenge going on now. Some of those people who are the representatives of political parties with a reasonable showing, even if some cases it's gone down, and the European Parliament are saying, you've got to choose one of us to be the President of the European Commission, because we're changing the whole Commission later this year. But sovereign governments are saying, well, we're not sure about that. We know we have to take account of the results of the European election and the views of the Parliament, but that doesn't mean to say we have to do what the European Parliament tells us. So the headlines yesterday, today, and the coming days are going to be about a political tug of war, which will take place between the institutions, principally the European Parliament, of the EU, and national governments, which may or may not want to appoint as the most senior players in the European Union, people who have found favor in the newly elected European Union. So I think it's going to be quite complicated, and there may be a bit of a fight between national capitals and Brussels, Luxembourg, Strasbourg, which are the seats of the European institutions. But it is a result of, I think, a level of dissatisfaction and probably hangover from what we call in the UK the Great Recession. In other words, the financial meltdown, which happened in 2008, began with the collapse of Lehman Brothers and hit the rest of us in a kind of domino fashion and caused very considerable hardship. We are feeling quite pleased in the UK. We've got 3% economic growth this year, but the European Union, as an average, is way down, and the Eurozone, the area where they have a single currency of the euro, is going to be barely in positive territory at all. Our level of unemployment is about the same as yours. It's sort of 6.5, 6.8. The average in the Eurozone is nearer 12. So, you know, we're still in a very severe economic difficulty in Europe, and I think this election result is in part a reflection of that dissatisfaction. Your second part of the question was, what does this mean for Britain's place in the European Union? Well, this is a complicated story. If my Prime Minister wins a fresh mandate in May next year, when there will be a general election, if David Cameron is still Prime Minister, then he is going to hold a referendum in the UK, about whether or not the UK should stay in the European or not, in the European Union or not, having first renegotiated the terms of membership so that he can seek fresh consent from the British people on better terms of membership for a better functioning European Union. This is something which hasn't gone down a storm with some of our European partners because they think, oh, there are the Brits who can't decide if they're European or not. They want to have their cake and eat it. They want a la carte membership. They want the privileges but without the responsibilities. All of which we would, of course, reject as being a misrepresentation of our position. But what it does indicate is that in the UK there is a great deal of Euroscepticism, and there is a very strong sense that Europe as presently configured and as it presently functions is not an institution which is working as well as it should. And I would argue that one of the consequences of the European Parliament elections and the way in which mainstream governments across Europe have been rejected in these European Parliament elections is that I think it shows that we are not alone in saying that the European Union and its institutions need to work better, need to be more accountable, more competitive, more ready to allow national governments to assume the responsibilities where it makes sense to do things as nation states rather than as an integrated European Union. And I know from talking to a number of my friends, including the Czech ambassador, I'm glad the honorary consul of Czech Republic is here, that in Czechoslovakia, in the Czech Republic, for example, as well as in many other member states, there is also a sense of Euroscepticism that is rising and Europe needs to work better. So I like to think, therefore, that what this may mean is that over the next year or two, there will be a general sense that Europe must be made to work better, in which case my Prime Minister will be able, should he win the general election in May of next year, to negotiate improvements in the way in which the European Union functions, and then seek, as he puts it, fresh consent from the British people for membership of the European Union. But at the moment, there is an issue about a degree of skepticism in the United Kingdom about whether the European Union is a good thing or not and whether we should be part of it. My government's strategy is to organize this referendum, having renegotiated the terms of membership, with the conclusion which means that the UK will stay in the European Union, will not leave it. That is not the plan at all, but a number of things have to be done between now and then to ensure that that outcome is possible. Of course, if there's a very different election result in May of next year in the UK, then that scenario of what and when and how a referendum will be held will look very different. So all this is hypothecated upon a certain set of political outcomes next year. I'm sorry, that was a long answer to your question, but it was a complex question and it deserved a good reply. Yeah. Sorry. Yes, go ahead.
Given your own work history, could you explain to us what both the history and the current nature of the relationship between Turkey and Great Britain is, and what role Turkey is likely to play in Middle East negotiations?
Well, Turkey is a country with which we have been involved for a very, very long time. The first English, as he then was, ambassador to what was then the Ottoman Empire went in 1583. And during the latter years of the Ottoman Empire, we were often involved with the French and with others in trying to ensure that the Ottoman Empire remained intact but reformed, looking after its different minorities. And was not gobbled away.
I think your mic's gone off, if you could speak up just a little bit.
Sorry. Can I just shout? Is that working? All right. So we were quite involved in trying to ensure that the Ottoman Empire remained intact but reformed and was not consumed by the Russian Empire, which was busy trying to take possession of some parts of that empire. Since the end of the Ottoman Empire, the end of the First World War, it's all been very different. Turkey, now a secular republic, Ataturk, the great founder of democratic secularism in a country which is 95% Muslim, which is quite an achievement, and a force for stability, perhaps one might argue at some cost in terms of the rights of the minorities that live in what is Turkey. But we have always taken the view, ever since Turkey felt that it wanted to be a candidate country, that Turkey should be allowed to join the European Union if it met the membership criteria. That remains a bipartisan aspect of British policy, and we would love to see Turkey become part of the European family of nations. After all, we used to call it the sick man of Europe when the Ottoman Empire was in bad shape in the 19th century. And in many, many respects, the secular democratic tradition which exists in the Turkish Republic is something which is very close to European values. There's quite a lot of work that still needs to be done to ensure that that happens, and there's quite a lot of opposition to it amongst some member states. So I'm not sure that's going to happen anytime soon. And I think it's fair to say that at the moment, some of the things that have gone on in Turkey over the last year or two have smacked more of an authoritarian approach to government rather than one which is inclusive and open and genuinely democratic. And that is a debate that we've had on the basis of our close friendship and shared values with our Turkish friends as necessary. But we remain firm supporters of Turkey and as a beacon of secular democracy in an unstable part of the world where there is far too much extremely dangerous, intolerant jihadism going on in a number of countries which touch on Turkey's borders. And the last thing I would add is that I think those who find it easy to criticize some of the things that goes on inside Turkey need to remember what it's like sharing borders with the different countries with which Turkey has got, in many cases, a very porous border with some countries which are not in very good shape and which are themselves a threat to the stability and inclusiveness, if you like, of existing Turkish society. Perhaps it's work. Is it working now? No. Yeah. Did anybody else want to ask anything? Or am I?
He's got one, but the microphone needs to be back.
Okay.
Coming to Alaska, and on a lighter note, the Americans are fond of our founders' documents of freedom, the Declaration of Independence, and our Constitution of Bill of Rights. Could you please be helpful in bringing the Magna Carta to Alaska as part of its tour?
I'll do my best. There is more than one copy. There's a Lincoln Cathedral copy and the royal edict that goes with it from 1215, which are going to the Library of Congress. But there's something called the Hereford Cathedral Magna Carta, which is paying a brief visit to Houston. Thank you very much. So there will be two coming to the United States. I think there are about four in the whole world. But I better put in an application for you to bring one of them to Alaska. I'll do my best, but I can't make any promises. Yes?
Ambassador, access to quality education is deemed by many, if not most, to be essential for future
political stability and economic progress in the world. We've been pressing our government through results and other advocacy groups to give robust diplomatic and financial support to this cause of universal quality education. The Global Partnership for Education 3-year pledging conference is coming up on June 25th, 26th in Brussels. And the United Kingdom has in the past been the leading donor in this partnership. And we thank you and are looking forward to your continuing leadership in this vital issue. Can you comment on this conference and international effort or give any preview of the level of United Kingdom pledge? And as well, is there any way in your role or through any access you may have that you can encourage greater U.S. support for the Global Partnership for Education? Thank you.
You know, in the British Parliament, there is a tradition when the Prime Minister is asked a question to which he does not know the answer. He replies, "I will write to the Honourable Member with further information on this important subject." I'm ashamed to say I do not know the answer to your question. I'm not even sure about the Global Partnership for Education, and I didn't know about those dates. But I thank you for bringing it to my attention. I'll be happy to find out where we stand on this. I don't know whether any of my colleagues is better informed than I am on this subject. They're all shaking their heads, so I'm not alone in my ignorance. But I'm sorry, I'm not better placed to answer the question, but I'll get the information for you.
And I have a report I can give you.
Okay. Thank you. What I would say, however, is that the British Council, which is the organization which is the cultural diplomacy arm of the British government, was extremely proud just a few weeks ago to hold its biannual conference called Going Global on Higher Education in this country. It was not exactly Alaska. It was just down the road in a place called Florida, also made famous by John Muir. We brought the conference here with the participation of more than 30 chancellors of global universities, and it is something which we put a huge amount of effort into. I think in the same spirit of this Global Partnership for Education, it is all about bringing together the exponents of higher education around the world, developing the partnerships between individual universities, and doing what more we can to try to take the benefit and the privilege of higher education to more people than are able to have access to it at the moment. So it is something we care about as a government, but I'll find out more for you about this particular partnership.
One last question.
Yeah, over there.
Yes, I have a question. Is Hadrian's Wall going to be rebuilt in September?
Well, Hadrian's Wall was never demolished. It's still there, but it's not quite on the border. You're right to ask me about this. In 4 months' time, there will be another referendum, which is a referendum about whether Scotland will leave the United Kingdom, having put up with the rest of us for the last 300 years. It is something which many of our friends around the world are a little bit surprised by, and it is coming up very soon. This is something which arose from the local elections in 2011, when the Scottish Parliament, which is a devolved administration in the United Kingdom, like the Welsh Parliament or the Northern Ireland Assembly, was bestowed with a majority in favour of independence for Scotland. The British government, the United Kingdom government that I serve, agreed that it would facilitate that referendum. The people who take part in it will only be people who live in Scotland. The rest of us who are British but don't live in Scotland will not have the right to vote. So it's quite a dramatic event, and if it is a simple question, and if it goes one way or another, it means either that Scotland will leave after 300 years of being part of the United Kingdom, and the United Kingdom, in my view, will be diminished by the loss of Scotland, or Scotland will stay. The polling suggests that it could be quite close. So there is a big campaign going on in the United Kingdom. The government of Scotland, the devolved administration of Scotland within the UK, is actively campaigning for independence. Alex Salmond, the First Minister of Scotland, is making the case powerfully wherever he goes, including here in the United States. The British government, but also the main British opposition political parties, in other words, all the mainstream British political parties, take the opposite view. They are facilitating the referendum, but they are not neutral as to its outcome. All of them take the view that we would be better together as a country rather than breaking up with Scotland going its own way. British government believes that there are a number of complicated issues to do with currency and investment and membership of international organizations. Would Scotland be part of the European Union? Well, no, not unless it reapplied. Would it be a member of NATO? Well, probably not, because they don't believe in having nuclear weapons, and you can't be a member of NATO if you don't accept the principle of the nuclear deterrent, quite apart from the fact that as it happens, the UK's nuclear deterrent is based in Scotland. Our submarines are in Scotland. And then there are other people who will say, well, what about Her Majesty? You know, will she still go to Balmoral Castle if Scotland is no longer part of the United Kingdom? So there are a number of different issues there. A number of businesses have actually raised the question about if Scotland is no longer part of the European Union, no longer part of the United Kingdom, not part of the single market, and doesn't even have a currency of its own, what does that mean about its own fiscal policies and the future of investments? And this has been raised by a number of organizations which are currently with major investments, financial services and energy and so on, defense technologies in Scotland, who are concerned about the future. So how will it go? I cannot tell you. At the moment, the polling suggests that the gap is not a very wide one. My personal view, as somebody who's been proud to serve the United Kingdom for 40 years, including Scotland, is that I hope we will remain together. But it is up to the people of Scotland to cast their vote, and it is my job to explain the British government's position, but I'm not here as a campaigning politician. I am a civil servant who serves the United Kingdom to the best of his ability. But it is it's a big deal, and it's a very significant vote coming up in just 4 months' time.
Mr. Ambassador, let me take the podium for just a second.
Yeah.
Well, on behalf of the board and the World Affairs Council, I want to thank you, Ambassador, for sharing your comments. We are trying to be sensitive to people who need to go back to work on their time, so if you need to leave, feel free to do so. I know the Ambassador will be here for maybe a couple more questions, so if you need to leave, feel free to do so at this point. And while I'm here at the podium, why don't I hand to you a gift from the World Affairs Council for you to take back to the UK, and hopefully you'll come back again and visit us soon.
Thank you very much indeed.
Ambassador, thank you. And for those who need to leave, please feel free to do so. The Ambassador's here for another couple questions. Carrie, go ahead and finish up.
And then was I thinking I was getting let off. Don't feel under any obligation to ask any more questions, but if there are, yes, please, go ahead.
So in retrospect, after what happened with the situation in Greece, it looked pretty brilliant for the United Kingdom not to have adopted the euro. So I guess I'm wondering if Turkey is taken into the EEC, what effect will that have on the economies of the nations which do use the euro?
I think I'm right in saying that any new member state that joins the 28 has to be prepared to join the Eurozone. At the moment, I think it's 11 member states are members of the Eurozone, and no, the other way around, 17 members are, and 10 of us are, 11 of us are not. And any new member state will have to be ready when the time comes, not necessarily on the day of accession, to join the Eurozone once they've met the criteria. I can't tell when that would be. Frankly, I think that the day when Turkey joins the European Union is still some years off. What would be the impact on the economy of the rest of the European Union? Well, I like to think that the impact would be a very positive one. It is a market which has been growing at 6 or 7% for the last decade. It is a country with a population of around 80 million consumers. It is a country which has been a source of very substantial and profitable overseas investment from everybody from Mercedes trucks to Burberry raincoats. People have their products made in Turkey because it's made to a high standard at a reasonable price and re-exported from Turkey elsewhere. So I think there are lots of respects in which economically Turkey meets the bill. Turkey's deficit, I was boasting a little bit that ours had come down by half from almost 12% to 6.5%. Turkey's annual deficit is less than 2%, the budget deficit. Their current account is not so strong, but their growth figures and their deficit, their public finances, are in pretty good shape. So my view is that Turkey, which is already part of the customs union with the European Union, would be an asset to the European economy. Of course, there would need to be a number of adjustments, and there would be some concerns about free movement of labor. Would millions of Turkish workers come to the rest of the European Union and swamp the market? Well, each time people have been scared about millions of people from Portugal or Spain or Romania or Poland just swamping the rest of the market, it hasn't really happened. There has been sometimes a brief surge, but it usually hasn't been nearly as substantial as people have been concerned that it would be. And frequently, because of the effect of membership, of raising the ambient level of economic activity and prosperity in the candidate country, people then go back home again because they never really wanted to leave home in the first place, and the levels of wealth rise pretty rapidly, even amongst the poorer members of the European Union, so that there's a degree of equality which means that the suction effect, if you like, of the rest of the European Union on the newly arriving candidate country largely vanishes. Of course, there are always going to be some exceptions, and it may not turn out to be like that. But in my country, for example, where there was great concern that the lifting of the last restrictions on free movement of labor would mean that there would be a complete, you know, massive influx of workers from Romania and Bulgaria, didn't actually happen. Hasn't happened yet. Quite a lot of people came from Poland for a while, but quite a lot of Poles have been home again since. Guess what? Hourly labor rates in the candidate countries come up to the European average once they have joined the union, and therefore people can be paid just as well for doing the same kind of work in their home countries. I would confidently predict that would happen in the case of Turkey if, as I hope, one day Turkey is able to join the European Union. But I'm not an economist, and it may be that things don't turn out quite like that, but I don't think it is a reason to have a great deal of concern. At the moment, there are more concerns about whether in terms of rule of law and openness and freedom of expression and protection of minorities at the moment, whether Turkey is quite where it should be. And there's more work to be done in that area.
Looks like you're off the hook.
Okay.
Ambassador, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Sir Peter Westmacott, British Ambassador to the United States. This talk was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and the World Trade Center of Alaska. It was recorded May 28th at the Petroleum Club in Anchorage. Thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org. For KSKA, I'm Beatty Trantina. Thank you for listening.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.